This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. Here's what's coming up on Africa News Tonight.
And so, yes, it is expensive, but if you do invest in climate change, it's actually a win-win for both Tunisians and investors instead of ignoring it, which is just going to cause the problem to fester more and more.
That's Sarah Yerkes, a senior fellow at the Carnegie Middle East Program on why investing and dealing with climate change is so critical for a country like Tunisia. Details coming up. Also, the EU criticizes Rwanda's military presence in the eastern DRC. And Cameroon says vaccine hesitancy is preventing the inoculation of millions of children. These stories and more on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. The United Nations humanitarian aid chief says conditions in Sudan have not improved at all in the last few weeks, and access to Darfur remains virtually nil. Martin Griffiths spoke to journalists at United Nations headquarters in New York today before heading to Addis Ababa tomorrow for an Intergovernmental Authority on Development meeting. Sudan's military has been battling the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces for control of the country since April. Hundreds of thousands of people have fled into neighboring nations, and the UN estimates over 2 million are internally displaced. The fighting has left cities without power, food, and water. Griffith says Chadian authorities are being extremely cooperative in getting aid workers into Sudan's western Darfur, but the security situation there is extraordinarily dangerous. Griffiths had a bleak assessment, saying, in his perspective, Sudan is a place of no hope at the moment. Following the deaths of a Tunisian in Sfax, allegedly at the hands of three migrants, violent vigilantism has erupted. Citizens have rounded up black people and hundreds have tried to flee the city. Migrant advocacy groups say at least 500 sub-Saharan people have been expelled from the country to the Libyan border. Reporter Elysia Volkman has more from Tunis.
Racial tensions in the city of Sfax on the southern coast of Tunisia continue to boil after violent clashes on Monday, where a Tunisian man was killed. Vigilante violence has caused a panic amongst the sub-Saharan community, causing many to flee the city. Tensions were further inflamed when the Minister of Health alleged on national radio that migrants are infected with tuberculosis. A member of parliament from Sfax, Tariq Mahdi, told Voice of America that for the moment, calm is returning to the city. Tunisia has become a major departure point for migrants seeking to get to Europe. Since the conflict in Sudan began in April, the number of Sudanese people crossing into Tunisia has increased, and many have congregated in Sfax trying to contact people smugglers to get on a boat to Italy. A local activist and online influencer, Ziad Malouli, earlier organised a demonstration to demand that the government better manage the large influx of migrants into Sfax. Ziad says he's anti-racism, but since the civil war in Sudan, there has been a massive influx of migrants, mainly Sudanese, into Sfax. He says, unlike now, there was always a community of illegal migrants. They worked and people got along fine. He says he used to run cultural programs with the migrant community. However, since the new wave of refugees and migrants, he says crime has increased and people are afraid. But he also condemns the police roundups and the vigilante activities. The government has remained largely silent. Voice of America has sent questions to the Minister of Interior to ask why it is forcibly expelling people without judicial process, but as yet has received no reply. On Tuesday, President Kais Saied reiterated his opposition to migration. He also said Tunisia will not guard the borders of other countries. However, he has offered no solution to the unrest, nor for those expelled into Libya. Bekan, a Cote d'Ivoirian, had been working as a waiter in a high-class restaurant before his arrest.
La situation est très critique. Il y a pas d'eau à boire, il y a pas à manger. Les enfants sont déshydratés.
Bekan says he was part of the first group of 20 that was arrested and expelled across the Libyan border early on Sunday morning. morning before being forced back by armed men. He says now there are over 700 people at the border crossing. They are trapped inside a military zone by the sea without access to fresh drinking water or food, so people are forced to drink seawater. He says there are many babies, children and pregnant women, some who are close to their delivery date. He says they desperately need help. Although Voice of America has seen a number of videos purportedly filmed by migrants which show pregnant women, children and injured people, Voice of America could not verify his claims. Those trapped in a no-man's land are enduring temperatures of over 46 degrees centigrade, with no water and constant threats of violence. Last month, a delegation from the European Union visited President Saied with an offer of a $1 billion financial package, including an increased budget of $105 million for better maritime border security and migration control. However, Tunisia is still considering their offer. President Saied repeated on Tuesday that Tunisia does not accept to be a guard of any borders except its own. For Voice of America Africa, I'm Alicia Falkman in Tunis, Tunisia.
A recent study by the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace says the effects of climate change in Tunisia are exacerbating economic inequalities and hitting to traditionally marginalized interior and southern regions the hardest. The study notes that the Tunisian government has failed to prioritize climate change in terms of resources and political will. Some observers say Tunisia's precarious political stability means the conditions are not right to support that endeavor, which will require $19.3 billion in financing over the period 2021 to 2030. Sarah Yerkes, a co-author of the study and a senior fellow at Carnegie Middle East Program, spoke with VOA senior analyst Mohamed El-Shenawi.
I think Tunisia is in a very difficult position because on the one hand, there's not a lot of donors right now stepping up to support the country at all. But on the other hand, they really cannot afford to ignore climate change. And this massive investment is only going to grow the longer you fail to address climate change. And also, you know, they need to think about climate as impacting other challenges. So if you do start to invest in climate adaptation and mitigation, you can help get at the migration problem, massive unemployment, water scarcity. And so, yes, it is expensive, but if you do invest in climate change, it's actually a win-win for both Tunisians and investors instead of ignoring it, which is just going to cause the problem to fester more and more.
So how hard is the impact of climate change on Tunisia in particular?
It's very bad. Tunisia is one of the worst countries in the region to be impacted by climate change. And we're seeing this play out right now in the water scarcity that the country is facing. And we also see this really impacting, you know, the areas that have been hit the hardest traditionally, the marginalized regions in the interior and the south. And so Tunisia is not only just kind of suffering writ large, but the people that are already the most vulnerable are the ones who rely most on agriculture and where water scarcity is really a problem and having such a large and growing impact on people's lives and their livelihood.
So how could Tunisia deal with the impact on its economy when it lacks the required funding?
Well, I think, first of all, it's not just an issue of funding. When you look at Tunisia on paper, Tunisia is actually quite advanced when it comes to climate proposals and strategies. They were one of the first and only countries in the world to put addressing climate change into their constitution, for example. But the policies, the priorities that they put forward just haven't been implemented. And I think one way that they can sort of get around that is through public-private partnership that could help alleviate some of the burden that's on the government, this government that really does not have the funds to address this right now. But if you bring in the private sector and help sort of get the advantage of the private sector skills and their resources to help address the gaps that the government has. The other issue is decentralization. So a lot of the climate problems that the country faces are really local problems that are going to require very localized solutions. The Kais Saied government has completely demolished Tunisia's decentralization process. And so one thing that needs to happen is a push to re-empower local officials and local activists that can help them determine the local needs and help address the local needs through, again, the private sector, the international community, other actors that can help fill in some of this gap that the government is facing.
Tunisian activists mentioned some success in implementing projects with international supporters, including the United Nations Development Program and the German Agency for International Development. How should the international community support Tunisia in countering climate change's negative impact?
I think there's a lot of room for the international community to play an important role in the climate space. Now, climate change, you know, certainly can be politicized. We see this around the world. But in general, you know, relative to a lot of other issues, the climate space is free from some of the political constraints that donors are facing in Tunisia and other areas. And so I think one of the things the international community can continue to do is to support the Tunisian civil society organizations that are already working on climate change. There's a lot of Tunisian CSOs that are really engaged on the local level and identifying the problems in their home territory and figuring out what needs to be done. The international community can help support those efforts with funding, but also with training and with other resources. There's a lot of examples globally of civil society groups that are really working to fight climate change quite effectively. That knowledge, that expertise can partner with the Tunisian expertise and work together to come up with solutions for the Tunisian context.
That was Sarah Yerkes, a co-author of the study and a senior fellow at Carnegie Middle East Program, speaking with VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi. Kenyan police fired tear gas into crowds of opposition supporters today as they marched into Nairobi's main business district and in other towns to protest tax hikes. Opposition leader Raila Odinga called the protests to oppose tax increases that have been imposed at a time when many are already struggling with high prices of basic commodities. Kenya's High Court ordered that the tax increases be suspended, but the government has raised fuel prices anyway, leading to a further court challenge. Police were out in force for the protests, the latest called by Odinga this year over the policies of the government of President William Ruto, who defeated Odinga in last year's election. Human rights group Amnesty International, Kenya's office, said police arrested several protesters in the capital and in western Kenya. Officials in Cameroon say vaccine hesitancy is preventing them from inoculating millions of children for childhood diseases in the first major campaign since the COVID-19 pandemic began. Cameroon has an outbreak of measles and rubella that has killed 18 children and sickened thousands this year. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé, Cameroon.
Cameroon's public health ministry says several thousand vaccinators have been dispatched to over 200 hospitals in the Central African country to inoculate more than 5.5 million children against measles and rubella. The government says the vaccinators are also visiting homes, churches, mosques, markets and camps where school children are spending their holiday time to make sure every child under 10 years old is inoculated. 36-year-old carpenter Ongene Pierre says he stopped the vaccinators from inoculating his three children at Nyom, a neighborhood in Cameroon's capital Yaoundé.
Il y a des enfants qui ont été déjà vaccinés et on ne tient pas à connaître s'ils ont été vaccinés ou pas.
Ongene says he doesn't understand why the government of Cameroon wants all children under 10 to be vaccinated. The government should have found out if some of the children have been inoculated or not, Ongene says, adding that health workers should not be visiting holiday camps, churches, and other public places to vaccinate children without the approval of their parents. Ongene said he has never received a vaccine in his life and sees no reason for his children to be vaccinated. Cameroon's public health ministry says measles and rubella have affected more than 4,000 children with 18 deaths since January. Jeanette Molua is a medical staff member in the public health ministry. She says the ongoing nationwide campaign targets children from 9 months to 5 years who are the most affected by the measles outbreak.
We should make sure our children take the 2 doses of the vaccine because this will boost their immune system. We should sensitize the public, those with rubella, we direct them to the hospital for them to get treatment. And also it is treated by the same vaccine, the MMR vaccine, which fights against measles, mumps and rubella.
Mulwa said the measles, mumps and rubella vaccine is safe and there is no harm getting another dose. Cameroon's Minister of Health says less than 30% of about 5.5 million children targeted for vaccination in the 5-day campaign launched Wednesday have been vaccinated. The government says a lack of trust is the leading cause of vaccine hesitancy. The government says a lack of access to vaccination information and long distances from vaccination centers and hospitals prevent mothers from getting their children vaccinated. The National Institute of Statistics says that Cameroon is a country with a high proportion of the world's zero-dose or unvaccinated children. The center says several pockets in Cameroon traditionally miss essential healthcare services, including vaccinations. Health officials say parents should make sure their children get two doses of MMR vaccine, starting with the first dose at 12 to 15 months of age and the second dose at 4 through 6 years of age. The ongoing vaccination campaign is the biggest since Cameroon reported its first cases of COVID-19 in March 2020. The government says when COVID-19 was reported in the Central African state, parents were afraid to take their children to hospitals for vaccinations because hospitals were also COVID-19 test and treatment centers. Health workers say a major challenge for them now is having access to some parts of Western English-speaking regions. Separatist fighters have declared that they don't want workers from the central government in Yaoundé in English-speaking towns and villages. Cameroon's military says it is protecting health workers and is asking civilians to denounce fighters against government troops so the vaccination drive can be successful. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. The European Union today blasted Rwanda's military presence in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo and support for Tutsi-led M23 rebels accused of atrocities against civilians. According to the French news agency AFP, EU foreign policy chief Joseph Borrell reiterated an EU urgent demand that Rwanda withdraws its troops from Eastern DRC, ceases immediately all support to M23. He also said the DRC must cease immediately its support of militias such as one known as the FDLR and protect civilian populations. The FDLR is a mostly Hutu group founded by members responsible for the genocide of Tutsis in Rwanda in 1994. Rwanda's government has used it to justify past interventions in DRC. Rwanda has denied backing the M23. Gunmen from Sudan's paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, RSF, have been accused of attacking a remote town today before going on a shooting and looting rampage that witnesses said terrorized its people. A witness told the French news agency AFP that the RSF was looting banks and public buildings in Bara, 350 kilometers south of Khartoum. He said the army was nowhere to be seen. For nearly 3 months, the RSF has fought the National Army in a war that has claimed the lives of at least 3,000 people and displaced millions. Ethnic divisions, clan mentality, and paramilitary force formations have become familiar facades in the everyday lives of citizens in the African continent. In a conversation I had with senior professorial lecturer and chair at the International Peace and Conflict Resolution Program at American University, Professor Kwaku Nuwama, he starts by answering my first question, is Somali's clan system undermining democracy?
I think the clan system as it's currently constituted is not helping the cause of democracy, but the main reason why the clans are playing such an important role is because the state has failed in Somalia. And when the state fails, that people have to migrate towards other centers where their needs will be met. And so it is not the clan's job to promote democracy in Somalia. It's the state's job to get its act together, give people a reason to support it rather than their clans. And then the state can help grow democracy by engaging civil society and international partners and building institutions and doing the things that the Constitution enables it to do. The state is unique in all of our societies, but when it fails, life must go on and people will go to the next best option.
Professor, what you're talking about, characteristic of only Somalia, but is it also seen in parts of Africa elsewhere as well?
Absolutely. In societies where the state is fragile, you have competing centers of authority. As the state ceases to be an effective manager of the economy, different actors emerge. In some places, a lot of African countries, the state cannot even deliver justice. People have to go to self-help measures. They have to rely on, you know, other actors to give them justice, to provide public services, to give them a sense of identity. Well, you've seen cases in Ethiopia, for example, where people feel the state is not delivering equitably to them. We've seen various places in, you can see Nigeria, for example, in some parts, depending on where you are, you don't think that the state is doing right by you. Same in Ghana, there are parts of Ghana where people feel very aggrieved. But if you go to eastern part of Ghana along the border with Togo, there's a secessionist movement over there. If you go to the upper regions of Ghana, on a border in Burkina Faso, there's creeping insecurity as people feel that the government far away in Accra is not speaking to their needs. If you go to DRC, the same thing. That people, if you're in the Kivu, the state doesn't quite reach where you are. And people then have to make do with what is available locally. And sometimes they don't have a choice. And so that's the problem. It's up to the state to give people a reason to be loyal to it alone. The state has unique qualities that other groups shouldn't have. For example, the state should have an absolute monopoly over the means of coercion and the delivery of justice. We don't want to live in a state where I have to go to my local chief to get justice for me or to provide security because I can't trust the government's police officers to do that. Then we get into dangerous territory. You want the government to be strong enough to do all of that stuff. The same way for everybody across the board. Otherwise, you're going to have conflict all over the country.
And lastly, Professor, these paramilitary forces, the one that is happening in Sudan, whereby there is the national army and then there's this paramilitary force. Are those offshoots of this kind of clan mentality where there is no allegiance to the state?
In the case of Sudan, it is actually the government that created the paramilitary force. It's part of the patronage politics of African societies for people in power. They themselves are not really, really 100% waving the national flag. Most of the time, they're waving an ethnic flag. So the people that support them, the people that they trust the most are people from their ethnic groups. And because you have this patronage system in place, those people get to be the ones who protect the president. So you have these ethnic armies, private armies, emerging usually around the presidency in a situation where the legitimacy is always questionable. You're going to have situations like that. You see what's happened with Wagner in Russia, where Putin essentially created this private mercenary group with his friend. And we've seen the conflict that has emerged between Wagner and the regular Russian army. Those kinds of things, they never really end well. You want a situation where security sector reform happens smoothly, where there's only one voice, there's only one chain of command in the country. Otherwise, you're going to have these split loyalties and you're going to always end up with a conflict.
That was Professor Kwaku Nuama, the senior professorial lecturer and chair at the International Peace and Conflict Resolution Program at the American University. He spoke with me from Washington, D.C. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Shogun Chang, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.